guys, from making stallions and curly stands to Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Friesian Fire, Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is running like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, second half, on this Wednesday. Lisa Lazarus will join us shortly, and in advance of that, let me slip in a couple of little tidbits. Day one, yesterday, up at Timonium, right there at the fairgrounds. Yeah, that one of the great scenes in racing is the horses turning for home with the Ferris wheel right behind it. Yesterday, the first of the Bree show, and I didn't look at any write-ups. I do have a list of the drills, and there's a few that were quick. You had a little bit, kind of a nice balance of horses going a quarter and horses going the eighth. Was there anything? I don't think there was. Was there anything sub 10? I don't think so. I think 10 flat was as sharp of an eighth as anybody made, right? Yeah. There's one hip. I don't have the catalog here. I actually forgot it at home when I left. We were so far out in front, leaving for Kentucky. Looks like hip 91, McLaughlin, went 10 flat. That catches my eye. Yeah, that looks like, I think that was the only, I'll have to look that up. I'll pull up the catalog online. A lot of 10s and 2, a lot of 10 and 2s, 10 and 3s. Yeah, but I think that was yesterday's only 10 flat. And it was a little breezy. We were, Greinig and I mentioned, that Greinig and I were not far away, actually. And I think I'm going to, don't know if I'm going to be there before they wrap up today, but I am going to, hooking up for lunch with Woodbury Payne, and probably his whole crew, Ferris Allen, and all the, all those guys. So, everybody's in town. Everybody's over at Timonium watching the Bree show. And I have to mention this because we had Cricket Goodall on the show. Was it last year? Cricket was named yesterday as the honorary postmaster. There's so many old traditions here that it's part of what makes it so great. And Cricket will be honored at tomorrow at the Alibi Breakfast. She's an institution around these parts for the Maryland Horse Breeders Association. The executive director, and she was when? Why? I forget. There was something else that we were doing. There was something. Was it the? Was it that library? I think it was the library. Maybe 2 years ago that was being dedicated, right? And they had the reception. Went up to that reception, and I think that's when Cricket was on with us. But this caught my eye, and wanted to acknowledge how respected and appreciated Cricket Goodall is. All right, let me reach for Lisa, and I think I can mention that tomorrow after the Country Life Farm function, I'm going to be involved in a Preakness chat. Stable Duel team, and I saw Bremont, the game that they're doing that Bill Gallo talked about, and I saw Bree on actually a couple times at the Iroquois, so I'm going to do something with her and Megan Conley tomorrow night. I think between 7 and 8. That'd be fun. All right. Let's go to Lisa. Look at me, right on time. This was very clever. The way we managed to tap dance and get the timing right. And then Sid will follow, and Seth Merrow, and Callie Francois. She'll be here in person, which will be fun. It's nice to get people to come visit the office here at up in the press box, even without the elevator working. Lisa Lazarus joins us. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. I appreciate the opportunity to react to what obviously has been a difficult and controversial and frankly a little ugly situation involving the medication overage of Forte in New York and the protracted legal wranglings that sought essentially sequestered or not in the public purview for a way too long a period. And one of the things that it appears HISA can do efficiently is make these kinds of embarrassments go away.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, our system is built to do that, right? To protect the trainers who are playing by the rules, and to also protect the betting public. One of the things that our ADMC program does that I think, most trainers really support is we divide very clearly our rule book into two categories. And one addresses what are truly doping substances, banned substances. And those are, of course, the anabolic steroids, the EPOs, et cetera. We treat them very differently, much harshly, than we do the other rule book, which is controlled medications. So the way that the notification process would work is that if it were a banned substance, if it were an anabolic steroid, as soon as the positive test was received by HIWU and certified by them, the trainer and the owner would be notified, and the trainer and the horse would be immediately suspended. And so actually the public would know about a doping substance, very soon after, within days of the trainer and owner being notified. We treat controlled medication differently, medication overage differently. What we do there is the public would be notified after the B sample confirms the A sample, or the trainer and owner waive the B sample and accept the positive test. And that would typically be, 3 to 4 weeks after. And there's one other really important tool that we have in the toolbox at HISA is that the Horse Racing Integrity and Welfare Unit, so the end of the agency, they can also, even for a controlled medication, they can ask the arbitral panel, this independent body that will decide these cases, to disqualify a result even before the entire, you know, case finishes, this case concludes. So in other words, if there is a, you know, horse that tests positive even for an overage in a qualifying race, and the race which they've qualified, the Derby, the Breeders' Cup, whatever it is coming up very soon, we can actually ask the arbitral panel to consider disqualifying the result so that the horse that plays second or third or whatever it is and race clean will be the one that qualifies for that race as opposed to the horse that had a positive test. And I think that will be something that will bring just a lot of certainty and clarity and probably comfort, I would think, to horsemen and also to the betting public.
And break out a few of the components, if you don't mind, Lisa, because, and in fact, the way you introduced that, I'll offer two scenarios. Using Forte, let's say, as an example, the case has been made that Forte couldn't run in the Champagne in New York because the process had begun, and so that's why they ended up racing in Kentucky. Basically, you know, there's no way to know. There's no way to know, you know, what kind of results how that might have changed things, and you know, his positioning to run in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. But when you bring up things like the qualification points, you make me think, what happens in, let's say, April, the first Saturday in April, a horse comes out of the Wood Memorial, the Bluegrass, or the Santa Anita Derby. How is the timing working to get a decision ahead of the Kentucky Derby? I mean, it would be, obviously, if a horse gets into Derby with qualification points from those 4 weeks out, and, you know, some of this is still not necessarily, you know, out in the open. I mean, that to me is an easy to understand, and obviously kind of a more recent, something that's fresh in everybody's mind. Explain how the mechanics, and I also want you to talk about, you know, who's collecting the samples, the regulatory bodies that are in place, and how is the lab testing going to be any different in terms of getting results back on a timely basis?
Okay, so I think what I'll start with, the first question is, and I think it's a good question, is, you know, what happens if a horse runs in early April, about 4 weeks before the Derby, and there's a positive test, okay? So first thing is that in order for a laboratory to qualify as a laboratory under our system, and we only have about six laboratories under HISA, under HILU, they have to agree to return the A samples within 10 business days, so essentially 2 weeks. Okay, so that gets us obviously sort of halfway through, and hopefully, you know, a lot of labs will be able to do a little bit earlier, but that's a requirement. It can't be longer than 2 weeks, and it's actually 5 days for a VEX list test. So we have, certainly compared to a lot of the jurisdictions, you know, quicker timelines that are required. If the positive test comes back, and if it's a banned substance, it's one of those doping substances, truly doping, then that's super easy because the horse automatically gets suspended and something happened very quickly. If it's a medication overage, and the responsible person decides that they do want to have the B sample process, it's then going to be up to the anti-doping agency, HILU, to determine whether or not they want to ask the arbitral panel to disqualify the result even before, you know, potentially the B sample comes back. And that will be up to the arbitral panel to determine whether or not there's sufficient evidence and essentially the equities favor that disqualification. You know, and obviously the trainer will have his or her due process, and that will take place. But it'll take place very quickly, and we have all of the pieces in place to make sure it happens quickly. The other thing that I would say is, that the way the laboratories will be different. And this is, I think, if you were to ask me, like, what's the biggest difference, the most important change or kind of, I guess I would say, step forward with the ADMC program or HISA's program, is that the laboratories are going to be harmonized. And I can't say enough, like, how important that is, because, you know, you can have uniformity of testing. So in other words, you can have, like, the Kentucky lab and California lab and Pennsylvania lab all testing for the same things, but they're not testing for them at the same levels. You're not going to have uniformity and consistency. So that agreement on these are our screening limits, we're all going to use the same ones, is going to give horsemen a lot of certainty. And I think, you know, certainly increase fairness and increase transparency and accountability, which are, I think, all the things, you know, we all want.
The screening process, and you mentioned the A samples and B samples. A lab like in New York, Dr. Malin, how do you handle a lab that consumes, you know, all of the collected sample, essentially doesn't leave enough for a B sample, for a split sample?
Well, obviously, that's very carefully regulated within our rules and our process. That's not, it's just not a possibility. You know, the New York lab will actually not be a part of the HISA program. So,
okay.
George Mellon's lab is not in our program. So if that's, you know, if that's just a New York issue, that's not a concern for us. But we have very specific performance requirements and procedures that don't allow for that possibility.
Okay, that's fair, because I mean, that's something that, you know, we've seen in as part of you know, travails, essentially, of mm-hmm. you know, of some testing mm-hmm. you know, challenges and contentions. There essentially then would not be any room for the kind of delays that were reported here, and in terms of the, you know, the Forte scenario, there wouldn't be any room to negotiate over the lab. It's going into the system, and the system is the system.
Correct, and there's also one other difference between the HISA program and some of the other existing state programs, is that the Horse Racing Integrity and Welfare Unit, so the agency that's running all of this for HISA, they select the B sample lab. I think, you know, one of the issues that sometimes does cause a delay is finding the B sample lab that everybody can sign on to. It makes it much easier for us that we have a smaller group of laboratories, because they have to be able to find all of these substances that we're testing for in order to qualify as a HISA laboratory. And so there is no worry about, can we find a lab that can actually, you know, do this specific B sample test? They all will be able to. And they all will be harmonized. So there's no, like, trying to, you know, figure out what lab is the best lab for a certain scenario. It will be primarily just based on logistics, right? So, like, if the A sample is in Pennsylvania, you know, we may say, okay, the closest lab in Pennsylvania is Kentucky, we'll send the B to Kentucky. You know what I mean? It's really much more based on logistics and efficiencies and cost efficiencies than worrying about whether or not they can do the work, because they'll all be able to do the work.
What portion of the the angst, I guess, or the, you know, the declarations of cheating, quote unquote. You know, for years we've tried to differentiate medication overages from positives that indicate, you know, an attempt to influence a horse's performance mm-hmm. enhancement. And you can use this Forte as an example, even though everyone is essentially acknowledging that this is a trace positive, very much potentially a contamination, and one way or another, you know, simply a therapeutic med overage, but yet Lisa, you see the same, I'm sure you see a lot of the same responses to this that you see when, you know, when there's associations made about, you know, actual attempts to cheat. And you talked, I think, in the conversation we had with you and Ron McQuett, one of the, frankly, exciting prospects was the potential for these kinds of overages to essentially not even, you know, not even get out there to be turned into a point of accusation. And to me, that would be a big benefit, because this notion, and no matter how many times you try to explain the difference between you know, the kinds of products that all athletes use, and even, you know, products that are absolutely regulated, the public seems to just utilize every headline as, you know, as a possibility to condemn everything associated with the game, and it's done us no favors over the last 15 years.
Yeah, I honestly could not agree with you more on what you just said. And it's one of the reasons why, one of the first things, you know, when I first took this job, there was already a draft in place of the anti-doping rules that had been worked on by USADA and the anti-doping committee. And one of the very first things I did, and it was based on the experience that I took from the sort of show jumping Olympic world, is we have to completely separate out, have two entirely different programs for medication overages and true doping substances. Because until we make, first of all, they should be treated very differently, in my view. And two, when we treat them differently, we separate them out, we have a chance of being able to educate the public about how different they are. You know, obviously, we want to promote responsible medication management, and there are sanctions if you don't do that properly. But it is very, very different if you're using like an EPO or growth or something like that to get a true advantage that's calculated, and, you know, versus not withdrawing a medication in time for a race, you know. And our program, our system really does that. And so my hope is that once we get going, when we're kind of transparent to the public, as we will be, about the cases that are in our queue and any positive tests that arise, we'll be able to use like that separation and that complete demarcation between those two programs as a way to communicate to the public when something is a medication overage versus doping. And, you know, and you see very few doping cases, you know, as you know, right? I mean, and so much of the time, unfortunately, the media interprets medication positives as being doping. And I think that's wrong. And I think Kaiser has a responsibility to do a much better job educating the public about what we're really talking about here.
Well, that'll be, I guess that's going to, I don't know if it falls to Mandy Minger to be the point person on that, but I can tell you,
she's totally involved.
Well, as someone who has tried to lay out those differences for decades. I mean, we had the RMTC discussions for years, and whether it was Dr. Waterman and later Dr. Benson and other, you know, tangential people in RMTC, no matter how many times we tried to explain this, Dr. Alday, Alan Foreman, no matter how many times, maybe I'm making an assumption, but it just seemed that no matter how often this was explained, every report of a non-steroidal overage, turned into, see, this guy, they're all cheating. Even the big guys, if people that are close to the business are thinking that way, then, I mean, the general public, it's hopeless to think that the general public is going to understand any of it.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right, and we just really need to do a better job as an industry on that. I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, all right. There's a couple of questions are coming in.
Okay, great. Well, I'm happy to answer them.
All right. In light of essentially a milkshaking positive, involving Robertino Diodoro. And there's actually something I'm going to drive home. I did as I did yesterday. What is the CO2, the TCO2 testing protocol, and how is it handled under HIWU?
So there will be a very significant amount of TCO2 testing. You know, it will be prosecuted as a prohibited method, so very, very quite seriously. If in fact anybody is actually sort of caught or determined to be using TCO2, and we will have, you know, a very significant program in place for we'll be doing a lot of TCO2 testing.
As it happens, the TCO2, you know, the milkshaking era kind of came and went, essentially. Well, obviously, it didn't entirely go. But I'm slightly amused when I see people saying, "Oh, see, they're cheating." Well,
yeah,
they just caught a horse that finished sixth and was tested. So you're going to tell me that you're going to complain? Yeah, this is like when you see people saying, "Oh, you see what's happening at the border? They seized truckloads of fentanyl." Right. Mm-hmm. They seized truckloads of fentanyl. that's a positive. They stopped This is a positive that a horse that finished sixth was caught essentially, you know, having been milkshaked. One thing about Lisa, and I'm very curious, because in California they're testing on a widespread basis for you know, for the overage over the 37 parts, you know, the 37 threshold. Other places are doing it. I think that Arkansas, I think that they're doing it for stakes, and they're doing it randomly and you know, picking horses, you know, just making sure that everybody's aware that they could get, you know, called to the test barn and have that, or is actually done pre-race. So I'm curious about this, and this is the same problem we've had with clenbuterol, that it clears the system too quickly. I mean, talk about the out of competition and you know, ways to get out in front of things as they're racing.
Yeah, so one of the things I think is really going to be useful in the new program is that, you know, there's been for decades, I think, such a significant focus on post-race testing. You know, you always need to have post-race testing. It's an important kind of tool in the toolbox, and you obviously want to make sure that there's this sort of prophylactic effect that people, you know they're going to be, or trainers know that they're going to be tested post-race. But honestly, from an investigation, like an intelligence-based testing program, you know, that's not necessarily the most effective way to determine whether or not a race is clean or that trainers are competing fairly, and et cetera. So we will be using, you know, one thing that you'll definitely see is way more out of competition testing the industry has ever seen. And I think out of competition testing is such an important tool because, you know, folks aren't necessarily expecting it. They don't know that they're, you know, when you put a horse in a race, you know, you have to expect that they're likely to be tested, at least have a very good chance of being tested. So by using out of competition testing, I think we're able to do a lot more sort of targeted and, as I said, intelligence-based. You know, we've invested very heavily in a very strong investigations team, you know, led by Sean Richards, who, you know, is the FBI agent involved in the New York cases and has a lot of understanding of how, you know, horse racing works, and some of the concerns. And so we're going to be, you know, relying on that and the horse racing integrity of competition, where they use TCO2 based on kind of what they've discovered, through investigations and through their intelligence. We'll also be using a lot of data. You know, we have a data analyst as part of our investigations team. We'll be using data as well. And all of those sort of pieces of information will be what drives the testing plan.
When you say data, we've had that conversation with, I think what you're referring to is, you know, seeing essentially performance figures. You know, Jerry Brown's Thoroughgraph numbers are they have been used, you know, to watch for anomaly, performance anomalies,
correct.
Essentially.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
So that's the data point you're kind of inferring.
Yes, performance anomalies, things that are unexpected. It doesn't necessarily mean that anybody is guilty of anything, but it certainly might identify a smart place to go look or to focus testing, you know?
Well, that's the old smoke and fire mm-hmm. philosophy.
Correct.
Is there a sample freezing program as part of the plan?
Yeah, we do keep samples for a period of time. It depends on, you know, there are a couple of different factors that go into determining how long, but we do freeze. You know, we do freeze samples for a period for sure.
And of course, freezing samples has been, you know, has been suggested for, you know, for years as a mm-hmm. recourse to, you know, to be able mm-hmm. as
science catches up. Yes.
Exactly. Well, and yes. You know, that's the way you've just phrased that, actually, Lisa. Lisa Lazarus with us, we're using the Forte non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication overage as a point of reference to see how the HIWU mechanism can, you know, expedite and, you know, alleviate us from, you know, these kinds of embarrassments, because that's what this is. And you know, the idea of, when I bring up the frozen samples, the idea being, as you suggest, discovery of undetectable product that isn't being currently tested for. What is going to be different, Lisa, on that front? Because that's one thing that, you know, that everybody points to, that, you know, if it can't be tested for, there's no evidence, and you know, there's nothing to base penalties and you know, fines and you know, basically, you know, driving people out of the out of the sport, people that are actually really attempting to cheat.
So, you know, one of the things that I think is really kind of an asset or a benefit in the fact that we have selected a smaller group of laboratories to be certified as sort of HISA laboratories is that we can invest in those laboratories, and there's an incentive for them to really work with us, develop the kind of testing and the cutting edge, you know, tools that will allow us to do this kind of work. You know, so that's one piece of the puzzle, is being able to kind of invest in these labs and not sort of spread out the resources, but really target them to the labs that we think have the best capabilities to do this kind of work. But the other thing is, don't forget, is that, you know, investigations are going to be a really big part of all this. We're not going to be relying solely on laboratories to detect substances. We're going to have other tools in the toolbox to determine whether or not somebody's doing something wrong. You know, like the prosecutions in New York, for example, you know, they weren't based on positive tests. They were based on, you know, investigations. And so we hope that, you know, certainly we expect and we want and we're going to invest in new testing and new strategies, but we're also going to really put a lot of effort into making sure that our investigators have all the tools they need to make sure that if there's, you know, there really is cheating happening, that we find it.
On that topic, we've brought up in advance as this system, you know, was taking shape and you know, understanding of who was going to, you know, which agency was going to be signed on. One of the topics that kept coming up was the old school TRPB, which was, you know, essentially a boots on the ground, you know, ear to the rail, you know, Pinkerton / you know, detective style police work, really. That over the years uncovered all kinds of whatever it was, whether mm-hmm. it emanated from betting, you know, betting coups and mm-hmm. you know, the jocks, you know, acting inappropriately, all manners, great and small, of attempts to cheat. It, one of the things that I kept hearing in those discussions, Lisa, was the, you know, the cost prohibitive aspect, and that does kind of get us to, you know, the dollars and cents again, that we, you know, you've laid out a prospective budget. Are we any further on that? And how do we envision paying for robust investigation and supervision and everything that comes with it?
Yeah, so listen, we are, you know, our budget, as I've explained like numerous times, is a kind of gross figure that includes all of the money that's currently being spent on anti-doping and safety by state racing commissions. And that really, we're just talking about that 15-20% kind of delta that, you know, that we look at as the underinvestment today. And to be honest, we haven't had any real challenges at this point in time in terms of, you know, collecting the money. And there are a number of state racing commissions that are doing some really innovative things. Like, for example, New Mexico, I think Minnesota, Colorado have all passed or about to pass, you know, laws in their legislature that cover HISA fees. In Florida, they passed a regulation that essentially gave all of the Florida racetracks a tax break that's commensurate with what the HISA costs are, you know. And so we're working to support states to make sure that they can essentially, you know, drive the revenue and be able to cover these costs. And we're, you know, being as efficient as we possibly can in terms of spending money. You know, we gave money back to the states from 2022 because we didn't spend to our budget. So, you know, I think, I'm constantly kind of lobbying for and trying to promote ways that we can essentially, you know, reduce the burden on horsemen and find ways of funding this through government programs, et cetera. So, you know, that's going to be something I'm going to have to keep working on really hard for the next few years. But I do think that we have a number of ways that will make this all affordable. And I also really believe that when we can tell the public, you know, when the public feels that our sport is safe and our sport is fair and our sport is clean and our sport is regulated in a uniform way, I believe that's going to incentivize more owners to enter the game, and it's going to really allow us to prosper financially. And so, you know, obviously, time will prove whether I'm right or wrong. But that's, you know, that's essentially my response. And I, you know, recognize how important getting the finances right are, and how, you know, how concerned horsemen are about it, and it's something that's on my mind all the time.
Well, not just horsemen, owners obviously, and horse players, because what one of the protections for players that was removed from the final version of all this, you know, for the longest time, takeout was not going to be a way to finance this. That players were already paying for enough, but that was extricated. Yeah. That was taken out of the provisions, and so there remains the concern, by legitimate concern, of players that you know, we're going to get handed a bill for this, and the players are already put upon enough, so are owners. I mean, everybody is stretched here already, you know, by a variety of factors that make a lot of things about the game tenuous financially.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I don't think there's any, you know, to the extent that the financial models have to be approved by the HISA board for the most part. And I'm not aware of any proposal to take HISA fees out of takeout. They all primarily are kind of shared expense between the horsemen and the racetrack. And sometimes there's, you know, a state effort to, you know, tax other places, but I'm not aware of any proposal to take the money out of takeout.
All right. Lisa Lazarus with us. Couple more follow-ups as people listen.
Sure.
And they, you know, we've had three or four of these, and they always provoke, well, number one, appreciation for you you know, being out front, you've been touring the country, going to racetracks, talking things, explaining things to, you know, to everybody, to, you know, all the horsemen groups and all the racetracks, large and small. And whether they're active participants or willing participants or not, you've been visiting, and you deserve tremendous credit for that. One follow up to the and this is more overall. It doesn't have to be just the milkshaking question, but where can people see the penalty schedule for violations?
Sure. Yeah, you can go on to the HISA website, www.hisaus.org, and if you go to the regulations section, you'll see, you know, when you go into it's the 3000 protocol, it's the 3000 series, that's the anti-doping protocol, you'll see all the punishments and all the sanctions there. And yeah, that's probably the easiest way to do it.
Very good. Give the address again.
Sure, it's www.hisaus.org.
Very good. All right. Also, back to really the original question, do you, based on what you've been reading and seeing from the Forte scenario, would he have been able to run within 30 days of that champagne positive? Would he have been able to run in a follow-up race, or would he have been shelved waiting for the scenario to, you know, to be decided?
So listen, I haven't, you know, I don't know, I know as much about the Forte case as the general public. You know, I just know what I read in the papers, and so I haven't seen any of the documents, and I'm not privy to the details. So I really have to talk about it sort of hypothetically, but hypothetically speaking, for controlled medication violation, there is an opportunity for HIWU to ask the arbitral panel to disqualify the result before the case is finalized. And if the arbitral panel would agree to do that, then there's a potential that if you gained your points in a qualifying race where that result is disqualified, that could prevent you, obviously, from then competing in the race that you've qualified for. So that's important thing. I mean, the other thing to consider is, you know, we may not have the same standards, you know, as New York, for example, for even determining whether something is a positive. You know, HISA has a number of, you know, contamination policies in place that, again, I'm not talking about Forte because I haven't seen, I really right. have not been privy to the details there, but you know, there's a question of whether or not, you know, this would have even qualified under any of our contamination policies, et cetera. So I can't even really speak to how it would have been handled from the get-go.
All right, because that's interesting, because as part of the coverage of this, the suggestion has been made, not vis-a-vis, you know, the HISA portion, but that this, you know, this was such a tiny picogram amount that it's not even a question that about it affecting performance. And so maybe that's a great point. It might not have even been called as a violation under, you know, under your schedule.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I have not seen what the concentration was for Forte, so I'm not speaking to Forte, but the substance itself, meloxicam, that's a substance that, you know, under the HISA law, we're required to follow the International Federation of Horse Racing Authorities screening limits, and their screening limit for meloxicam is public. You can go onto their website and see it, and it's 10 nanograms per milliliter in urine, and it's 1 nanogram per milliliter in plasma. So, you know, I don't know the details of the Forte case, but we will have, you know, there's a new system in place for HISA, and so I can't, you know, we can't say for sure what even the outcome would be from the beginning without knowing the details.
Well, 500 picograms was the measurement.
Yeah, I mean, what I could say is, one nanogram is 1,000 picograms. So, I won't say more than that, but you can do the math.
So a half. So a half of a nanogram.
Right. Correct.
So they're the bottom line from the original from our original starting point, which was does HISA offer the potential to make a situation like this either never even see the light of day, given a kind of a practical approach to the products in question, and even if it does come forward as a called violation, that it would be publicly broadcast and explained and adjudicated in a period of weeks.
Correct. Well, I wouldn't say so. Let me clarify that. It wouldn't be adjudicated in a period of weeks. It would be, the public would be aware of it in a period of weeks. It would obviously take a little bit more time to go through the full process of the arbitral panel and, presenting the case and the trainer obviously having his or her due process. But it would be known to the public within weeks.
Lisa, but that point sort of opens the question to the the same potential legal wranglings from that point. Does that exist? Does that scenario exist, or is there less legal recourse under this as an authority, essentially?
Yeah. So the entire kind of process on a controlled medication violation will typically be about 3.5 to 4 months from start to finish. Again, the public would be aware after a few weeks, but, getting, the process of essentially, scheduling a hearing date, allowing for, the presentation of the case and allowing a certain period of time for the panel to actually write their decision, that's going to be about 3.5 to 4 months. Typically, but that's, significantly shorter than what we've seen in recent years from state racing commissions.
Okay, but I'm back to something I say to you seemingly on a regular basis. How is that different than what we've got already?
So it's very different for a couple of reasons. First is that the public notification within a few weeks.
Okay.
No one knew about a lot of these cases until months and months later. Second is that there is if it's a doping substance, they're banned, they can't compete. If it's a controlled medication, and there's a qualifying race involved, the HIWU will likely ask the arbitral panel to disqualify the results. And so the result can be disqualified ahead of the next big race, which is also really different. And I can tell you that 3.5 to 4 months is a very short period of time compared to some of the cases. You have to balance that with, giving the trainer some amount of due process. They have to have the opportunity to at least explain themselves, argue their case, et cetera. So that's, that is, I think, a very, very extended time frame and a very reasonable period of time. And again, for me, the transparency of it all is also incredibly important, is that it'll already be out there, people will know about it. The responsible people can be asked about it, heading into a race, that the information will be there. And the tools in the toolbox to keep the game fair will be there. But we always have to balance, obviously, that focus on keeping everything fair, with fairness also to the folks who are going to be sanctioned. So that's really, I think, the balance. I think that's a really, really good, fair, solid system and balance for the industry.
Well, I mean, the priority will always be, ferreting out, real clear attempts to cheat and to utilize,
right.
To utilize things that are not supposed to be in the racehorse. That
correct. And so don't forget that on the doping substance, and this is the thing that I think is so different, is that because they'll be suspended immediately, the incentive is on the responsible person, the trainer, to get the case over quickly because they're going to be suspended until it's resolved, you know? So that, whereas right now the motivation is the delay because it's status quo until it's resolved. Whereas under our system, it's suspension until it's resolved. Now that's different for the therapeutic overages for the reasons we discussed, because that's not doping. And so we need to afford trainers more fairness, more time, more balance, with those cases. And that's why they're not suspended pending the outcome, but the outcome will still happen in 3.5 to 4 weeks. And if, you know, they have a medication overage in a race where it's being used to qualify for something else, we can get that result disqualified ahead of time.
I think that
is a really big difference.
No, so that is obviously, and so the, when it comes to therapeutic meds and overages reported, they'll be handled quickly, and there may be longer term legal wranglings, but the immediate portion of the penalty in terms of a disqualification, that'll at least be handled. But I don't know. At least I mean, it seems that there's enough open-ended elements here legally that we won't see this in practice until we see it in practice.
Yes, but I, you know, again, I'm really confident that there's going to be a very meaningful difference, and that once sort of trainers see it in action, that they're going to be very happy that we have a new system.
All right.
and a unified system.
Lisa Lazarus and Heisa, and final question, Lisa, the Monday, the 22nd, what will everybody, will anybody see anything immediately different, or does the mechanism just start to work on a widespread basis at that point in the jurisdictions where it's being applied?
So the difference I'll see, I mean, for anyone who was looking or watching the week of March 27th, learned the fact that that will be the difference. I mean, you'll see unifying, you know, sort of everybody, all test barns will look very similar across the country. We're using a paperless iPad-based collection system with a transparent chain of custody. You'll see that. So, you know, when samples are taken and they're all entered on iPads, and trainers will sign with their finger on iPads like you would for like a UPS delivery. That will be the, you know, what looks different on day one. And then obviously, you know, the other changes will only come into play if there are positive tests and how they're managed.
All right. Well, the train pulls out of the station, I guess.
Yes, it does.
Lisa, we'll continue to check in, and you guys have been so, you know, you particularly, you know, and made yourself available, and everybody that has come on board, continues to try to do everything they can to help the industry, you know, understand the, you know, the, how it's going to work and why it can work and how things will be better. And that's what we're all hoping for. So thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate the chance to talk to your listeners. So thank you, and have a wonderful day.
You too. We'll talk soon. All right. Lisa Lazarus, everybody. And I don't know. I find in these conferences, this is probably the fourth time we've had one of these, and we always get to a certain point where it just seems that a lot of the existing areas of frustration still have potential to jump up and trip up the game in one way or another, in terms of embarrassments and black eyes and, you know, head shaking, eye rolling, inexplicable scenarios. So, all right. As usual, I appreciate Lisa providing us with those answers, and, some other questions come with the answers. I've got somebody, though, that's got all the answers.
I was just about to counteract that statement because I knew you were opening up with that CBS.
You knew where I was angling?
Oh, absolutely. I said, you took a look at me. I said, nope, I do not have all the answers. That's what I know I don't have.
You've got the answers about Friday and Saturday's winners.
I mean, are we sure about that? This is now telling the future. So I'm not going to say don't quote me, but this morning Steve was the only one. Hi, guys, those who are just tuning in, Callie, Francois, hello. Welcome to the Steve Beck Show. But just taking a look, this was my only morning out here. Previous week started last Thursday for me as far as reaching out to the local news stations. Just a lot of local press has been happening. So I have just made it out here this morning for the first time watching some of these horses train. I will not be there tomorrow morning. We will have Samantha Perry, Claudia Spadaro, and Naomi Tucker coming in, taking a look at all these horses training tomorrow. So be sure to check out their socials, because they will probably be giving their opinions on socials of how everybody's looking in the morning. But is that kind of the point that we were going to get to, Steve? Who's looking good leading up to these big couple of days? Why don't we start with the Black Eyed Susan?
All right.
Okay, so, sorry. It's just I sprinted up here from those, because as for those who do not know, the elevator is out of order.
It's been discussed. We prepared everybody weeks ago when I was in Florida for Florida Derby. Dave Joseph said, don't expect the elevator to be working. We can't find the repair guy.
You know what's funny is that, well, I'm not going to say it on air, but yes, highly expected that the elevator just does not work. So let's turn ahead to the Black-Eyed Susan here. 9 furlongs on the dirt for the straight three-year-old fillies. Of course, Asia, obvious favorite. She looked great. She looked fine when Jimmy took her out this morning. Took her out earlier, a bit later than his Kentucky Derby runner. Looked fine. Everything fits the bill there. She's the obvious go-to. Let's skip past her because she's so obvious in this race. Originally, I had underneath was Hoosier Philly, and then, comparative for Radcox. I saw Merlaza come out, and I was immediately impressed with her. This one, Florent Giroux, gets the ride, won a stake over at Oaklawn, late April, comes over, ships over. Brad Cox does okay when he does ship over. Last year, he was 3-for-6 in his Pimlico runners, but 100% in the money. So with these two, the comparative came out to my attention because first, he's given this filly a little bit of time, runs her in a nice 100 numbers of one at Keeneland. To me, her progression in numbers, that's what I see for a price. 12-1 morning line.
12-1.
Exactly. That's what I thought.
Wow.
Yes. So I'm like, I don't know if we're going to get that. Do you need a minute?
No, I got it here. Okay. I had not even really looked. It's funny because I printed the PPs before the line was published. I've got 6-1 on Merlaza.
Sorry, I was talking about comparative. Comparative is 12-1.
Comparative is 12-1.
Comparative is 12-1. Merlaza is 6-1. Merlaza just, I had her down underneath, but now she's moved up to my number two, I believe my number two spot, just because I was so impressed with her physically when I saw her come out of the barn this morning. She's a nice size filly, Steve.
Well, comparative, here's another Godolphin. It's just unbelievable.
Are you surprised at 12-1, or should I be?
No, part of it is that Faiza, this field for the Black Eyed Susan has got the same issue, even though, I mean, it's a bigger field, so the prices are going to be spread around. This field has got the same issue that the Preakness field has, in that, the favorite is going to, be a black hole, essentially,
right?
And take all the money, and other other horses are going to be out of whack. That's what's so exciting about the Black Eyed Susan. I'm going to be hard pressed on Friday not to do something with Taxed, who looked so good coming into the... They were so eager to get in with her.
And she looked good, too, Steve, this morning.
Good.
She looked great.
Good.
So, price of 15 to 1, absolutely. Cats in the Timber is a nice size one as well, though I don't have that one underneath on my underneath picks. But
a little slow with these.
Yeah, yeah. So I just I feel like there are some quicker fillies, even though I do like Cats in the Timber for just a couple of kind of gritty type of reasons. But I do believe there are some faster fillies in this race.
How about liking her because Brittany Russell's 7 for 12 since we moved over here from Laurel.
Yes, yes.
there's another reason.
58% in the money, or in the winner's circle. I mean, I believe she got her first trainer's title here at Pimlico several years ago, so it all tracks. So I believe she's been stabled here, I believe, because she walked over from the other side of the track. Her other contingency, her whole contingency for Preakness just shipped in this morning, so she will be there in the morning, but any press, leave her alone. She likes her privacy. If you think it's Brittany, it's probably her assistant. Just taking a look at, Taxed. I did like the look of Taxed. I didn't see Balpool. I really wanted to see Balpool.
Balpool,
but I'm very intrigued.
You got to be. I mean, in terms of number power, certainly those of us that are sheep players, the two wins, the back-to-back wins, the off-the-turf Memories of Silver, and the allowance win, granted one turn. In fact, she's never gone two turns. Even the visit to Laurel was the one turn mile.
Mm-hmm.
But Rob Atrus, plenty dangerous.
He shows up.
Yeah, well,
he shows up. Sacred Wish is one who I have underneath.
Well, I had George. I had George on.
Did you?
Losing track of days. Had George on Monday.
Okay.
And George,
she looks awesome.
He likes her chances.
She's a nice big filly as well. I have her actually, I think, in my exact. I might have her in my exacta. I don't know. Merlaza really sold me this morning.
Interesting.
Yes, big time. So I think she's going to get it. It's that inside post that I think she is just going to adore today for Sacred Wish and the Black Eyed Susan. 10 to 1.
Well, and of course, George owns a Black Eyed Susan win.
Yes, he does.
Point of honor.
Yes.
The Black Eyed Susan goes off as the 13th on Friday, and there's also the 2-day action. I'm going to have Peter Rotundo tomorrow morning to talk about the
fabulous
the betting.
He's fabulous.
The rest of the card. Let's any other spots that you want to hit on Friday?
Oh gosh, I mean so many. I love the undercard. That we've got going on. Let's see. I'm just going to scroll back real quick. Pimlico Special. Surprised how many. There's Law Professor, but a local one who I have underneath is Armando R. I think it's the distance. This one is going to enjoy this distance here today. The only thing that does scare me is Deal DeVico is not great. Shipping over from Laurel to Pimlico, 1 for 22 as of late, combines. When I say Laurel to Pimlico, that's combining not just this meet, but a couple of meets prior. To just get enough of a stat. Let's see, what else? Let's head on over.
Yeah, it's true. He's a tick. He's a couple of ticks below at Pimlico than he is at Laurel.
Mm-hmm. The Hilltop, interesting enough. It's going to be interesting. You have a couple of not fresh faces, but It's pretty set there as far as Chad Brown versus Clement in that race. Delacour, let's take a look at Delacour. Delacour, here we go. Delacour, second time routing, 37% as of lately. 9 for 17 with 2 seconds and 3/3. So 13 for 19, second time routing as of lately. With Georgie Rui, who has been on fire ever since coming back here to Laurel. He's been on fire down in, he's ridden a couple of nice races down at Gulfstream Park at the championship meet as well. You also have Into Mischief, 16% second time routing, and Blame, 23% second time routing as well. For After Eight, Arnaud Delacour, 12-1. So there's a little bit of a price that I have underneath there.
Jonathan Thomas.
Yes.
That looks like a filly that well into the 11 with Sayas.
Yes, absolutely. I saw her this morning, liked what I saw. Jonathan's not here yet, but his barn has been running things ever so efficiently there. Miss Preakness.
Any beating? There's no beating Kia Life, is there?
Right. I mean, no, not really. It's going to be, I'm going to be interested to see how afternoon, I have her for underneath, well underneath, but I'm going to be interested to see how the Berset horse runs.
Afternoon tea.
Yep. This will be a nice, this is a nice step up, quite a bit of a challenge for her. So I'll be interested to see how that
cutting back
on.
From seven though.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, we should mention, there's also, the Bill Parcells, Maya Engelhart, cross traffic filly, Maple Leaf Mel, that came back for the 3-year-old debut and was terrific, winning that Eastview. And she's okay.
Okay.
I mean, she's I'm just looking at, yeah, I mean, she's a little slower than Kia Life, but not much.
Right. She'll put in a good run for the money. So with me, with this kind of caliber, you only know who's going to be the best because they're just, we're talking about 3-year-old fillies and you're talking about speedy 3-year-old fillies. This is the type of situations where they first get challenged. So you really don't know how they're going to handle that adversity unless you really dig in there and take a look at how the dam and the siblings, how game they have been. And then that's exactly what you go off. You go and look and see what other heart there is in the family.
Well, in fact, that came up, it's funny that you say that, that came up yesterday with Blue about stallions and about their passing along, you know, that trait of the toughness and desire. Kia Life, the only graded state winner in the field and the only horse actually that's tried graded state company. The rest come out of some state
state-bred, yep.
Yeah,
state stakes.
Restricted company elements and, you know, maiden winners. Shortish field in the Miss Preakness. All right.
The very one. Short on the turf for the girls, 3 years old and up. Spun Glass underneath. Mike Trombetta. This one didn't win this one. Wasn't this one last year. Didn't show up at all last year. This time last year in the very one. But because that was because this filly is first off of a layoff. This filly is now second off of a layoff. She is a much better filly when she's going second off of the layoff. She did this. Let's see. I'm trying to think of when she did this. But she won the Jamila down here, down at Laurel of last year. But this is a filly that also gets along with Fergal Lynch really well. So we have Fergal Lynch back on. We have her second off of the layoff. Mike Trombetta, 17% second after the layoff. That's fine. But 19% with Fergal on the turf, 4 for 21. And then let me do the math real quick. 11 for 21 in the money on the turf. So that's definitely one. I think I might have her in my exacta. Ken the Queen won last year.
So I was going to bring up this last year.
I think I might try and convince her for an interview on that one. But Victor, this whole trio last year won the very one, going to the lead, not looking back. Also coming this, my only stipulation
second
is
second off the layoff
this,
last time.
Exactly. This one's first off of the layoff. I don't love her first off of the layoff. So that's my only stipulation about this filly. But I do love, I'm a Spun Glass fan, 10-1 underneath. Everything kind of runs through the Kelly Breen horse a bit. Not much of an excuse for over at Keeneland. So as long, that's my question. Can he get one to bounce back once it's fallen off the rocker with Breen?
Trained Artemis you're talking about out of the Giants Causeway, which really, really did kind of go sideways. Although turf horses at Keeneland that don't like that course, sometimes you can put a line through
it. Fair enough.
Because it's not like anywhere else. That sand-based course is not to everybody's liking. Before we talk about Saturday, the rest of this card is really strong.
It's
Friday.
It's great, yes.
And lots of allowance action.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you want to draw attention?
Okay, so immediately, let me scroll back to it, but immediately before the race that we just talked about, the eighth race, the allowance optional 62.5.
Yeah.
You have Johnny Z from Albany coming back off of the layoff, this time under tutelage of Phil Capuano. But I just got to look at Fort Warren for Brittany Russell coming over from Baffert's barn. really cool horse personality-wise, but looking really good. This is a horse that Brittany had a really big smile about. So she's a fan. She's a fan of the horse. Looks every bit of the 7-5 that he is.
Well, and Baffert.
On top of that, specifically Brittany with these horses from Baffert, she's doing fantastic on. I mean, she's not only is she getting horses from Baffert, but she's getting the third string from Rapoli, from Todd. Whatever's not working out at Todd's, she gets it down here. She's had a bit of success with the Rapoli Russell string. But Brittany Russell, 32% with a new horse in the barn. This is one that's going to go right into that stat. So. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and of course, we talked to her after the win in New York, which was kind of cool.
I thought I was going to see this one. I was going to see that one at the Pimlico Special, but that's not clearly that's not happening.
Well, I think they got to run the Met Mile, don't they?
I would assume so. Yeah. Yes.
All right. So that's Friday. Let's turn to Saturday. Preakness card, and we'll start with that feature. And I did not see him gallop this morning, but
I didn't either because I was back at the barns.
Well, I saw Beige yesterday. I thought, you know, second day on the track looked terrific.
He does look good from what I've seen on social media. Yes, and he looks good. He looks good in the afternoon. He comes back. He's everything. He's very relaxed, calm. There's, you know, he's a professional, so he fits the bill as your Kentucky Derby winner coming into Preakness, ever the professional. But let's talk about the outside horse First Mission, Brad Cox, Luis Ayazad, who I have, and I would do a box exact on both of those, specifically coming in for this race. I mean, right away after he won the Lexington, that was the first thing that Brad said. There, so no question. There's not with so it's going to be it sets up very well for him because you have National Treasure who gets an inside post and the blinkers on only when, granted it was going short, but going to the lead, that's where this horse needs to be. This horse needs to be on the lead or just sitting off of it where First Mission can just sit right off of National Treasure if that works out.
Coffee with Chris is going to get the lead.
Coffee with Chris will get the lead. Well,
National Treasure, We know what Johnny and Baffert like to do. This horse is not that fast. He's a one pace type. He's gonna be ridden for speed from the gate.
Right.
But I think what he'll end up doing is gaining some position. Coffee with Chris is going to have the lead into the turn. Then you'll have First Mission basically drafting, you know, that spot that you know so often whenever you look up you'll see Luis Saez perched there. You know, basically
right.
Sitting
yes.
Second, third. I don't think he has to be right up on.
No, which is why it sets up perfectly well. So when you have Coffee with Chris and National Treasure setting up there, so it's going to be Coffee with Chris. He's got to show the gate speed that he went 7 furlongs in the spectacular bit in the heft. While he has been on the lead, especially in that Federico Tessio, I would argue a little bit. I'm going to counteract a little bit with some of the numbers and figures that I get. That if National Treasure with the blinkers on is going to sharpen up a little bit, especially being in that inside post, there's potential for him to get on the lead. Now, does he need to get on the lead? As you mentioned, I agree with you. No, he does not. So it would be perfect for all of these worlds and all of these horses' worlds if it went Coffee with Chris, National Treasure, First Mission, going in, being into that first turn.
Yeah, you got to assume that Javi Castellano will use a little bit of Meja's tactical foot to basically be
and sit sandwich right in between that. Yes,
basically get off. You know, basically the two path. Kind of watch as the three of them
just get a pocket behind all those
exactly.
three. It'll be First Mission and Mage sitting, you know, next to each other, maybe Mage being a touch behind, but we're splitting hairs here. This is horse racing. That hardly ever happens the way we plan for this to happen, but
it almost doesn't.
Perform wanted to have early speed. In fact, talking to Anthony Hamilton earlier today, that's Shug's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
He normally has more gate speed. So for him, even in that run at Tampa, that run at Tampa is the ideal trip for him. So he's not going to be as far off as he was in the Frederico Tessio. Because let's talk about the Frederico Tessio and perform for just a hot minute. With perform, he didn't get out of the gate, but then when some of these horses who are used to being quick out of the gate and getting to the job done, getting to the job and to the assignment really quick, and then they don't break out of the gate, what happens is then they get, once they break, then they get a little bit rank. Then they want to get going, and that's a little bit at the wrong time. So on top of that, that was going on a little bit. So he was well into Fergal's hand. Then he gets shut off by Sheldon Russell. That's where the drama started. And then Fergal was just completely uncomfortable the entire way around there. He had a ton of horse. And then you get to the top of the stretch, and Fergal is just trying to make something happen. He was picnicked in the entire time, and so he won by, you know, spots opening up, and he was enough horse for that to make happen, which is why I have him underneath. If you're a kind of horse who can overcome the drama that he had in the Frederico Tessio, that's where the Frederico Tessio gets a concern to, you know, just enough of a little bit of attention for a price of 15-1. Absolutely.
Well, and there some interesting elements to this, of course. He's the third Good Magic in the field, mm-hmm. With the Derby winner and with Blazing Sevens. And for those that haven't seen the Tessio, this is an agile horse. I mean, the way in which he jumped tracks and never really... You know, never really gets out of stride.
He never really ran in the Tessio.
And so for those that are worried, one of the things that Andy Serling and I were talking about perform last night, and he said, isn't he too slow? Doesn't he have to make up a lot of ground?
He never had a chance.
And I kind of tend to agree with that. And frankly, Woodford and Lane's End, they've got plenty of money. Mm-hmm. Still, to write a supplement check for $150,000 to get him in this race, these kinds of connections are too savvy to put up $150,000 to run seventh.
They don't,
or
exactly.
Sixth. I mean, it just seems like, and we talked to Shug last week, and Shug was pleased with where the horse is. On paper, you think, he's a cut beneath. I mean, that's what everybody's making out of this field anyway. I mean,
right.
That everybody's a cut beneath
right.
The Derby winner and with a little Baffert and a little Cox and
right.
a little Chad. But it'll end up, everybody will say, you know what? That wasn't such a bad Preakness after all.
I think it's a much better Preakness than what everybody makes it seem to be. I think this is, everything's exciting because you have the Kentucky Derby winner coming in and all of the, you know, hoo-ha going around it. But then on top of that, you also have a Kentucky Derby winner who came from well off of the pace. And I had Mage underneath in the Derby just Ooh. Based off of his Florida Derby performance. So this is another one that can come from trouble. So it's going to be interesting to see. It's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out. I mean,
but it's Mage and First Mission for you, essentially.
It's Mage, First Mission, National Treasure, Perform, Blazing Sevens. It was hard for me to leave him off. It's a hard fight between National Treasure and Blazing Sevens, and because you have, what do we have? We have Chad Brown, who's 29% third after the layoff, versus the stat of Bob Baffert with the blinkers on at 22%. So, ideally, you want to, you know. You kind of want to say, why not Blazing Sevens? But I just need to be a little bit more convinced. However, with Chad Brown's success in the Preakness, I could be, you know, this is me putting my foot in my mouth, but that's fine. I'm not, like, this is not the first time this has happened, Steve. So, I want to be just... I'm not quite convinced enough. I think we'll see a great showing of Blazing Sevens, but I think with the momentum that a handful of these horses have in this race right now, I think he has to really make his own race in here today in on Saturday.
I think he's hard pressed, personally. Yeah. Let's hit a couple of highlights, and obviously early in the card, Arabian Lion's going to be 2-5 mm-hmm. or less. As we sort of hinted, the Friday stakes action a little bit more intriguing. How about
I don't know about that.
Why? What do you got?
I mean, I'm seeing all of the, I'm seeing the, it's the Chad Brown and the Graham Motion showdown in the Gallerette.
Yeah,
oh
that's
my
true.
Gosh, I'm so intrigued.
That should be good.
Sopran Belicia, I need to go back and review my notes that I had on her before scratching out of the Dahlia because I think I took a look at some of those international races. But, what was it? I do have a bit of a tip on a horse, not in a stake race. Here we go. Race number 5. It's not a stake race. We're going to take a break from stake races right now. An allowance, 8.5 on the turf for the girls 3 years old and up. The number 12 in Uncorked. This one, Brittany Russell, Sheldon Russell on. This is an Elkstone horse. Now, this horse came from Australia. This horse was in the barn of Gay Waterhouse. I had a conversation with Grant about it. He gave me the whole shebang. But then I also shot Blake Shin a message asking him about the horse as well, because he was the only one to...
Because you've got Australian ties.
Well, I simply asked, and Brittany's happy enough with this horse, but... I'm just so thrilled by having a horse, you know, Australian horses come over here and run. Gay really couldn't find a spot for this horse. She couldn't quite figure this horse out well enough. So you, in these races over at Randwick and earlier, they're shorter races. Gay sets them up really successfully for their first, second time out. But after that, really had a tough time positioning where this filly was. Got the win at the 1600 meters, going to the lead. She's quick for an Australian horse out of the gate, which equates to an average American horse out of the gate. But I think she's going to be quick enough. She's probably going to go to the lead. I think the mile and 16th is a touch long for her, but I would definitely, at a price of 12-1, put her underneath. The only concern is that she may run out of heart. That was a bit of her problem. She's going to take the lead, but once horses get to her, she says, I've done my part. I'm not a fan of these horses getting in my way. I'm done. So we'll see, but I'm excited. I'm personally just excited to see that one run back. But let's dig into a couple of these stakes. Enough of this allowance talk.
All right. Now I'm glad you brought it up. That's a fun sidebar.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun to dig into a little bit.
Do some turf sprint work and the Jim McKay, the 10th.
Okay.
Field at 12, and. I thought this had a lot of the usual suspects, but
it's usual suspects that I don't love. I love Phil D'Amato's on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
That gets that outside
Here
post. Going to be that's the big. This one has been needing a break like that. This one's been doing all the hard work for a while.
He's got a dry in, right? He's AE, isn't
he? I don't believe so.
Is he? Oh no. Okay. No, he's not. Nope. No, he's not. He's in the body of the race.
Nope. He's done all the hard work. In his campaign. He's been there, done that. So then that's an interesting one. I'm just the Dale Romans one. Easy, flashy number. Why not?
Coppola.
Yep. Let me see. Determined Kingdom. No. Grateful Bread. All right. Let's talk about poor Grateful Bread. Madison Myers has had this horse ready to go since the horse was peaking at the time of the 22nd of April when the races were canceled.
Right.
Then entered in the King Leatherberry. And was a scratch because it was off the turf.
Right.
So this horse has been cranked, ready to go. He's okay off of the layoff. You go back to 2022 in the King Leatherberry last year with Toledo on. Now Sheldon's on. My only concern, Sheldon may need, I'm not saying Sheldon gave a bad ride on the horse in the Laurel Dash. I'm not sure of the chemistry between the two. It's just something I picked up.
What is that training center?
Middleburg.
Oh.
Yes.
Nice.
I hopped over there last year sometime, and it was it's a great private little track that's all forested in. Think of Delaware Park, but a little bit cooler, just a little bit more quieter.
Nothing's cooler than the little track that could.
Yes, exactly. Cooler as in temperature, because that's what I meant. Because Delaware gets pretty humid pretty
yes,
fast.
It does.
It's in that valley, so yeah, not fun. Michael, okay. I don't have this horse picked at all.
Michael Moore's, that's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
But Andy Hernandez, Michael Moore, 9-for-5 on the turf as of lately. 56% in the winner's circle. Every time they come, and almost every time Andy has come down to Maryland, pretty much, I want to say 80% of the time it's resulted in a win.
Interesting.
So horse may come underneath just with that alone.
How about Michael Moore? 3-for-7, 6-month layoffs or more.
How about that?
Right?
Yes.
That's a nice horse. And I tried to reach him after the Turf Monster last year.
Okay.
And we never connected. He got back to me a couple days later. I want to bring up John Service as well. Speaking of filly horses, Uncle Ernie's okay.
Uncle Ernie is okay. Because you have Talent Search, who's 20%, second time on the turf, 6-for-30. Broken Vow, 13%, that's fine. You also have Paco Lopez on an inside post, short on the grass. Hello. That's absolutely happening. This one, as you mentioned, ran in that turf monster that you just mentioned last year in September. That's my own personal... That last run on the 24th of April may have me convinced a little bit on him. But overall, I'm very much against and need the lead type and... flash in the pan type.
He's shown some
grittiness.
He's shown speed going longer. This is 5 furlongs, mm-hmm. For all I know, Service entered him in here with an idea that the thing could end up coming off. I mean, historically, the John DeSantis axiom is that either Black Eyed Susan Day or Preakness Day, one day will be rain. Johnny's maintained that, and he's been right.
There is 50% chance of rain on Preakness Day.
Well, Johnny has made that for years, and he was always right. One or the other days would get wet. But so I don't know if Service entered here thinking it could come off. He's only tried him that one time last year in the Turf Monster on the grass. But this horse has got speed going longer. And he, with Paco hustling, he could get brave.
Mm-hmm.
George Duarte's got nothing better. Who's got speed?
We barely need to talk about that horse because the horse is so obvious in this race.
Yep. And Force Harp has got Butchie Reed is coming down too with a pace factor.
Yes. So plenty of pace in this short but speedy dash on the grass.
All right, that's the turf sprint. Let's pick another spot or two.
Let's do that.
Callie Francois with us, and Callie will be anchoring all the festivities.
Yeah, just when my boss just peeked in as we're speaking right here at Old Hilltop, just going through the rundown with him. So I will be I'll be hosting for the most part, but I can't stay on the desk for too long. I've got to get out there and have some fun for myself. So I'll do some track side hits, some turf side hits, and yeah, let's get this rolling. We've got some great talent in Samantha Perry, Claudia Spadaro, and Naomi Tucker coming back in for the weekend, previously working here at MJC. So you have a group of women leading the charge here in Maryland.
Nice.
And it's a stellar group of girls.
I'd say. Want to talk about the Murphy, which for years has been one of my favorite spots on this card. And it leads into the Preakness. I think I found a price in here.
How about Circling the Drain? That's a Russell runner.
Who I'm aware of and I respect. I like the other 8-to-1 shot, that Kingfish Stevens, who feels like he's going in the right direction for Carlos Martin. This was a Larry Best bred that was a decent enough $75,000 Keeneland yearling. And, moved to Carlos. Carlos got one run in on the dirt at Aqueduct before moving to the grass, which resulted in a real good try against my man Siaka's Sell Something. I thought this horse is clearly a turf horse and is sneaky in here at 8-to-1, and you get Javier riding back. I I'm interested in Kingfish Stevens.
Javier riding back the race before the Preakness. Watch him get in at a price, and just he'd be coming into Preakness on a high, just ready to rock and roll. I love for Javier. Let's see.
Circling the drain for Brittany, you're talking.
Yes. Let me see what I was moving
to the grass.
Yes.
Out of a Cozine mare.
Yep. Daddy's Cozy, Comfy Cozy. Winners on the turf in Maryland. Let's see. I thought there was some stakes action. But actually, here we go. Here's what convinced me. With amongst the half siblings for Circling the Drain, the most meaning. Routing on the synthetic, sprinting, routing on the dirt, sprinting and routing on the turf. The biggest success amongst the half siblings has been routing on the turf. 8 for 34 in the winner's circle. 8, 12, 16 for 34 in the money, routing on the turf.
Hmm.
Which, Circling the Drain, to me, let me get back to that horse really quick. But from what I understand, that I feel like that horse does need a little bit of a freshener as far as just mentally. So this would be a good mental freshener for him to maybe open this horse up a little bit as well. So that's I see that going for that. I think Circling the Drain. Yes, Circling the Drain. He's one that does, with the way he looks and moves, he spins a little bit. Spins the wheels a little bit on the dirt. I see this one enjoying the turf. We also have Wonder Where Craig Is coming back in the race prior. Not to jump around, but in the Maryland Sprint, I see the end of it. So, nope, that's all we need to talk about the Maryland Sprint. Wonder Where Craig Is, very excited for that. But Knightley Stevens, Carlos Martin, yep. Wonderful Justice. I don't have much of an excuse for this one. Yeah, I do. Plenty of upsets and clashing and bumper action. That was a bit of a mess in that race. So, Grand Motion potentially having a decent weekend.
Nagarok, you mean, on the outside?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kind of easy to go with.
How about the... let's look at the dinner party. I've not looked at this.
Dinner party.
This is, again...
How long ago did Preakness win in the dinner party?
1870...
I thought it was 1870.
1870?
1870. Okay. Yep. Let's take a look. Let me get to the dinner party. All these races to scroll through. Here we go. Race 8. Ooh, not convinced by the 9 to 5 on its own. I'm not.
That's fine. I'm quite happy.
This one's gonna hate this inside post.
All right.
Definitely not a bit of the need the lead type, but this one likes having his own spacing. He likes to have, I can just tell right away, this one is one that really likes to have things go his way, and he's not going to get his way with this inside post, unless he floors it. Which, if he floors it and he's clear, we saw Kendrick do that successfully.
There really is not a lot of other pace pressure looking around here.
It may work out for him. So I have him third. Who do I have? Never Explain. I don't have him in my picks, but Never Explain was a good third here last year in an allowance, I believe.
Yeah.
Or no, he won. Yep, he won. He won at a not so much of a price, but...
Oh, that was Preakness. That also, yeah, that yep. was actually, you're right. That was, I think that was Black Eyed Susan Day
yes.
with Pratt. And then came back, and then Suge came back again. And
in the fall
in the second level, yeah. And Forrest just missed. Got collared late.
Probably a failed experiment of putting that horse on the lead.
Is Forrest not riding?
She's not riding a ton.
No, huh? All right.
I'll look into that.
All right.
Yeah.
Get back to me.
I'll get back to you.
we got a minute.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Hurricane Dream. Interesting. Easter. I'm really intrigued by Easter with Castellano on top. Yeah. With the dinner party. The dinner party was actually the hardest one for me to choose down to with my selection. So if you can... I'm not going to say hit the all button, but oof. My...
No all buttons. Come on!
No, I know, but... Because... gosh. It's, you have, never explained. You can leave that horse. Rising Empire, I think the Walsh Barn is just doing well as of lately, but a lot of these, that's a grand motion race. I feel like it's a grand motion race.
That's a fair conclusion. We will, if there's any extra tidbits you want to slip in, let me know. We'll get a special. In the meantime, it's nice to see you. I didn't see you.
It's Monday. Been crazy. Yeah, it's been crazy for me this entire time. I have a meeting. I have a meeting in about 2 hours to go through the whole rundown, and we know there's still information that we don't have. I was stuck inside all day just planning and plotting.
That's part of the.
We still don't have all of it.
That's part of the whole.
The revolving door of information.
Miss Francois to you, of course, on your Twitter. And Callie, thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Steve. Thank you for having me.
I'm running off to Maryland to see our 2-year-old work.
There we go. Maryland and Maryland.
Are you coming? You're not coming to Country Life tomorrow, are you?
No. I will be. I'll be on Fox 45 in studio that morning. Tomorrow morning. Yes.
Well, this is tomorrow, though. This is in the Thursday evening, 6 to 8.
Preakness party in Baltimore.
All right. Thanks to Callie and to Lisa Lazarus. Sid will join us tomorrow, and Seth Merrow as well. Eric Hamelbeck and Dick Powell. Indiana, Horseshoe today. Pick 5 and pick 4. No changes, really. And back with you here at Pimlico, 9 o'clock tomorrow, replay 6 to 9. SiriusXM at the races. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.
XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.